heard a loud... It's back. We're back.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast for empathy and imagination. My name is Aubrey.
And I am Drew Clark. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show.
Gradient Studios coming at ya. Sierra Nevada German style IPA.
As well as their peach IPA. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Like I said, my name is Drew Clark.
My name is Aubrey. Whoops, sorry to step on you there.
You're good. You're good. Don't forget to check out our website, empathyandimagination.com. And of course, don't forget to buy all the fine products from Final Corp.
And we are on iTunes and we are on Patreon.com, Empathy and Imagination.
If you would like to support this podcast, check out our Patreon page. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so how you doing?
Oh, man.
How was your week?
My week.
How are you doing?
See how I'm doing. It's been interesting. There's been some opportunities coming up. There's been some changes in the wind. And it appears as if that there may be an opportunity for one of my jobs to offer me a full-time thing. And it's less money, but I wouldn't be able to go outside, but it would be like Benny's and cool.
It'd be indoors
the whole time. So that's a thing. So that's like a thing. I've worked in my yard, like sort of a garden update. And
we put in a fire pit last week.
Mm-hmm. We got a sweet fire pit now. Worked in the Gradient Studios. Now it's looking pretty sweet. And that's been feeling really good. It's been feeling good to work on stuff that matters to me, mm-hmm. and to think about ways to improve what I want to do. And of course, I have a topic based on that. But let me wrap up how I've been, and just say I'm a little tired at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished riding bicycles.
90 miles.
90 miles. Over 2 days with 60 pounds of stuff, bicycle camping. So yeah, well let me switch that around and go. Hey, friend Aubrey, how are you doing? How's your week doing?
Doing good. Week is good. Same thing. Working on incremental gains, using systems to increase positive probabilities through incremental improvements. Because everything is practice.
Hmm.
Everything that you do, thinking, speaking, looking, it's all practice. So, you know, some mindset shifts, slowly, incrementally adjusting mindset.
What's a mindset that you've had that is moving?
I had a negative mindset for a while.
Oh, good of you to
notice. More negative than it is now, and it's pretty negative now. Just kidding. just a step towards, I guess you'd call it mindfulness. Concentrating on the present moment. Don't get bogged down with the past or the future.
Interesting.
Because they don't exist, really.
You've been thinking more positively about being mindful?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. You've been reading on that or just sort of discovering it internally?
I mean, I read a lot. There's a lot of books that drift through my transom. Mm-hmm.
Transom. That's a boat thing.
Yeah, like... I can't even think of the titles now, but yeah, I've been reading some, I guess you'd call it self-help or psychology, psychology books, self-improvement.
You ever get into
Tony Robbins? It sounds really cheesy.
It does. I've read a lot of it myself.
I've read Tony Robbins before.
Yeah.
What's the one? Absolute Power. I read that a long time ago. I don't really remember it, though. There's a lot of NLP in there, neuro-linguistic programming. Mm. Thinking positively, visualization. I think Tony Robbins was a disciple of some of the people who founded NLP. Mm.
That would make some sense. So you've been having a better time of that. That's cool. Well, thanks for saying that. What, and congratulations. Is there any more on that, or is that it?
That's it. I mean, it's an ongoing process. But that's it for now.
Have you met any new people?
Yeah, I guess I've met new people recently. Your neighbors. Those musician guys live down the street from you. They're friends. That's true.
They're friends and neighbors.
Yeah, so it's been pretty good. You'll hear me groaning and complaining throughout the episode, breathing heavy, because I'm very sore.
It's like a supreme understatement, I would say. Like, we spent the last 6 hours being in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
You have to go to youtube.com by Curtis Warriors.
All right, cool. So now, are you checked in?
Am I checked in?
Are you feeling, is there more?
That's it.
Okay. So,
do you have a topic?
I do have some topics, and there's kind of like, okay, so let's start with the last thing you just said, and we'll go backward. So there's this thing about pain endurance and or suffering for a greater outcome. And people talk about what's going on, they're usually trying to avoid suffering. And like, you think about mindfulness and meditation and sort of the point of a lot of what people are trying to do with their psychological headspace.
Yeah.
As they're trying to avoid suffering. And yet you and I just chose to suffer a whole bunch. And I think that there's some empathy and imagination opportunities in there, because I'm curious philosophically about pain, endurance, and or suffering for a greater outcome, ?
Well, that's what Atlas sort of depicts, right?
Yeah.
It's a very old representation of a man bent over with the weight of carrying the world. And Jordan Peterson, whom I admire, would say that that's what makes life meaningful, is suffering such that doing something that takes you into the zone, and that may be something that causes suffering, but that makes life worthwhile. Because without suffering, you would just be probably a pretty boring person, right?
So we need to suffer?
We might need to suffer to make our own lives worthwhile.
Should suffering be on our own terms? Should.
I think so. I mean,
wouldn't it be cool if?
It would be cool if it was. I mean, widespread human misery, that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, if I chose when you suffered because suffering was good, that wouldn't be so cool. And that's kind of more like the into the rights territory.
And I don't know if riding your bike is truly defined as suffering.
No.
I mean, you're definitely suffering under self-inflicted choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's physical pain. There's tons of physical pain.
You choose to test the limits of your endurance.
Yeah.
Which causes physical suffering.
I mean, if I can speak to pain endurance, like yesterday when we were on this trip that you got to go to YouTube Amazon.com/bikeorderwarriors to check out. I philosophically, I think I reached a point where my mind had mostly given up, mm-hmm. and I felt uncertain about the future and what was going on, and it was getting sort of delirious, and I was shaking. Whenever I would get off the bike, it was sort of hard to sit still,
mm-hmm.
and I was cramping. My legs were, if I didn't do it just right and sort of massage them and help them along, my legs would cinch up into a crazy knot when I would fully straighten them. And so when you fully straighten them is the only way to take a break on a bicycle, because you stand up and mm-hmm. you straighten your leg and you rest on the joint. But when I did that, they would snap. So I had no brakes for a part of, you know, when we're going on. So I'm in this, and my mind isn't thinking like, oh man, I really should stop this pain. I'm thinking, I really want to complete our goal.
Yeah.
It's like, I want to get to this place, and it's worth this, it's suffering, I guess.
Mind over matter, too.
Maybe suffering's not the word there. Maybe there's a new word opportunity.
Might not be the word.
Yeah.
But it felt like suffering.
How's your taint, would you say?
My taint complaint... Taint complaint factor 5, which is pretty high, probably the highest it's ever been.
Yeah.
Chafed, like butt bone, inner butt bone.
Yeah. Just
not even chafed, just like abused.
Yeah. It's like you imagine it's been chewed on and it's like bright red, it's probably.
Like that, it's like that scene in Casino Royale when the villain tortures Bond in that chair. Anyway, if you don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm not sure if I've seen that one.
Again. Yeah.
Okay.
But basically, he's like whacking on his taint.
Ah.
Ugh. Maybe not his taint, but.
I mean, when you sit back down on the bike seat after you've gotten a little break.
It's almost worse.
It's almost worse. It's because it's like you're lying on your back and somebody's crushing down on your taint with like a metal pole.
Mm-hmm.
But it's your body weight being pulled down.
And you can feel how much body weight one has.
Yeah,
even
because
even if you're a light guy like me, I weigh 60 pounds. And even then, it's just, man, it's brutal.
Well, I weigh like 260. And there's all kinds of stuff, you know. It's being a big guy, it's cool doing these long endurance things because I use such a huge amount of energy to go the distance. Can really feel it because everything on me is heavier and bigger, and so there's like more fuel being burnt or needed or used or whatever. I'm not really a physiological scientist, but yeah, I mean, pain endurance, suffering for a greater outcome. Is there a downside? Is if we use our imagination, do you ever get somewhere where that goes too far?
Where what goes too far?
Choosing to endure pain. I mean, like, I think about people who are trying to perfect like a musical recording or something, and they'll go over and over and over and over, and they'll never release it. And they're enduring all this sort of internal,
like a perfectionism type of deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a version of suffering too, and it like never comes out. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, perfectionism is strange because I think it's like a safety mechanism. Like if you just put something out and people hate it, you can say, "Oh well, I didn't work that hard on it." But if you just are working on it all the time and never release it, you can justify, well, I'm still working on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm kind of more of an advocate of like 3 drafts or like, you know, 3 revisions and then release it into the wild.
Wow.
And then see.
Yeah, yeah, how it goes.
Just don't release your first draft, maybe the third.
Okay, that seems cool.
3 revisions, release it. Software is like that now. They just like quickly turn it around and test it.
Wow.
So
I think if suffering is going to cause good, it's got to be chosen by the person. So like if there's a, like we'll say like a culture.
Like Christ? Or
maybe. Well, if there's a culture where it is culturally appropriate to remove the female genital organs with a sharp rock, and that's a version of suffering for what they think like is suffering. A greater good, right? But it's almost like it would be, wouldn't it be cool if the person got to choose knowing all the options about that kind of suffering? And that's sort of like, that's turning it on its head a little bit, because it's really saying like, well, who's in charge of administering the necessary suffering? It's almost like one, maybe it's best if one chooses to go out and hike to the mountain and starve, you know, as if someone else telling them they have to or else.
Yeah. I think you have the right to choose your own suffering if you want to. Ascetic monks, you know, that give themselves 50 lashes to simulate the suffering of Christ. And, you know, even the symbol of the cross is really, it's a powerful symbol because it's not really a symbol of hope. It's kind of the symbol of suffering. It's a symbol. Yeah. It's a symbol of physical suffering, of
punishment,
punishment by the state, and betrayal. So it's a very potent symbol for sure. And you know, the Buddhists say life is suffering.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah, suffering is pretty fucking cool.
It's pretty fucking cool. You heard it here first, folks. The podcast for empathy and imagination. Suffering is super cool. Actually, you didn't hear it here first. We're basically anecdotally talking about where we heard it from. Okay.
But that does remind me that our sponsor, Final Corp.
Ooh.
Final Corp, everybody. Final Corp has this thing called downloadable suffering. And check it out. It's not yet for humans. It just makes your computer suffer.
What's
still pretty cool though.
It just
still
improves the computer's abilities because it suffered.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Just puts a little thing in the corner that says suffering level, suffering meter.
Suffering. Well, thanks, Final Corp. I sure appreciate all your awesome products coming out also from Final Corp. Shorter nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
So the new product that they've developed up in the lab there at Final Corp is now they figure out a way for you to have shorter nightmares. So if you have really rough nightmares and they're feeling really long, then just go ahead and get the shorter nightmares from finalcorp.com.
Or if you don't have nightmares at all, you can get free nightmares from Final Corp. This is a promotional offer. Free nightmares, and they will be guaranteed to be a little shorter than normal nightmares.
So if you happen to not be having nightmares, if you use this product, then when you do, they would be shorter.
Right.
And you may happen more often. Side effects may include more often nightmares.
And you got a topic?
Yeah. So this sort of winds into a thing we started off on a little bit earlier, and we're coming back to it now. So this is another sort of philosophical question idea, and it's sort of a choice. And we've talked about it a little bit, but I want to bring up goods and bads of both and what we think about when it comes up, maybe a story. Choosing to pursue a life of having money versus going hobo. Like literally just stopping the pursuit. And just going, I will only get money when I absolutely have to. I will live free, whatever way I can, wherever I go. And there's lots of people who do this.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally considered homeless. And there's kind of a gradient of homelessness, you know. Like homeless with a cool little trailer thing, or homeless with a bunch of meth. Homeless with nothing.
Homeless and riding the tracks.
And maybe you just got a sleeping bag on the railroad tracks and you're good to go.
Hmm.
Hobo Joe. So, and then, or you can go to get a job in San Francisco and work and work and work and try to climb up to get as much money as you can for as long as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And try to get your needs met that way. Is there, you know? Yeah, is there a gradient in between? And is one or one or the other good or bad? And what are the pluses and minuses? So, Aubrey, what is the pluses of choosing to have a life of pursuing money?
Well, money is really a tool. So you could probably argue that you live longer, more money you have. You have more freedom, more free time.
Heard.
You're basically...
Wait, more freedom, more free time? I don't know if that's... I don't think that one fits in there, because if you don't more work free at time? All, you have lots of free time.
Yeah, more free time.
If you choose to pursue money.
Well, I think you have more of a choice of what you do with your time.
If you're choosing to... Well...
Because you don't necessarily have to work all the time to make money, right?
Well, I would say, if you're talking about time, the going hobo completely trumps every other option as far as personal free time. Because...
True, but you don't have as much freedom to do with that time what you want.
When you're a hobo?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, you can't just like go into the studio and play your guitar.
Yeah, but if you're pursuing money, you're always in the office. So the time question...
Well, I mean, I don't think so. Always in the office?
Well, often in the office.
Often in the office.
You're never in the office when you're a hobo.
Yeah. But if you are doing something cool in your office that you own, maybe that's actually something you want to do. Being in the office isn't necessarily suffering.
Okay. Next question.
That's what I'm saying.
What would be a downside of choosing a life of pursuing money?
Well, beyond a certain point, studies have been done, surveys, and beyond a certain point, it doesn't buy happiness. Like, if you can meet your needs and have a little bit of throwing around money to get stuff to spend on things that you enjoy, that's like pretty much the tippy top of happiness.
So the
people that are super wealthy are not more happy than people meeting right. All their needs.
People say, I've heard the number is like, for not, this wouldn't work in California, but in the U.S. on average, $75,000 a year per person. Any more than that is like, doesn't make you any happier.
Yeah.
California, so you have to raise that to like 100, but.
The downside of getting obsessed with making money.
Okay.
To the detriment of like, you're not even paying attention to your family or things that you actually enjoy doing.
Is there anything else? Are there possible downsides to choosing to pursue money?
Well, sure. What do you? Don't you think so?
Yeah, I think money is like a religion. And, oh, is it? Is it going?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Sorry. I think money is like a religion. And there are levels of piousness.
Yeah.
And there are leaders of the religion. And it holds a lot of power over society, how we think, what we do. And I think that as with many intellectual pursuits, there are downsides to the whole thing. Because money is a great individuator. A dollar is somebody's dollar. It's not two people's dollar. So it really, what it does is it makes it so that power must always be gotten from your community, peers, and neighbors.
In a capitalist system you're talking about?
In order to gain money, you have to get it from somebody, and you have to get it from people. And now, of course, if you're providing a service, then you could say, well, that's the whole point. I'm just saying, where it comes from is your community.
Doesn't capitalism make you more altruistic, though? Because in order to meet your needs by getting money, you have to create something that someone else wants.
Or so you can just purchase legislation and you don't have to make anything anyone wants.
That's like the edge case, right?
Well, it's the most powerful case.
Most people aren't doing that. Most people in capitalism are buying and selling things that they want or someone else wants. They're meeting needs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of them are manufactured needs, right? Why do you need a choice between 20 detergents?
Yeah.
So, you know, I get it. But also, capitalism is sort of intrinsically altruistic because you have to produce something that someone else wants. You have to help someone else in order to live.
Like you have to sell something to someone else or create a service mm-hmm. to someone else in order to subsist. You can't just make something for yourself.
Mm-hmm. So by definition, you're creating things. You're trying to meet others' needs. And they could be manufactured needs again. Mm-hmm. But it is sort of intrinsically altruistic in that way. You're not really thinking about yourself. You are that you want to make money, but you're thinking about what can I provide that will be valuable to someone else. And that's kind of a good mindset.
That's a nice way to think about that angle.
You know, just screwing everyone over.
Yeah.
Or like everyone, you know, everyone just gets the same amount of stuff. Even though I work hard and they don't work at all. That seems more unfair.
If there were people like freeloaders.
Yeah, and we already have freeloaders in the capitalist structure, but.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. What would be the positive elements about going hobo, like letting go of the pursuit of money as a religion and freeing your mind to go everywhere else? So that's a positive.
You'd be sort of off the cultural grid.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be constrained by time. You'd still have to meet needs of shelter, food.
Mm-hmm. You still have all your needs. You'd be probably toughen up in certain ways. You'd probably like get good at sleeping outside. Yeah. Because sleeping outside is not the end of the world.
Do you think it encourages criminal behavior to exist in a hobo state?
It doesn't encourage. I wouldn't say choosing to go hobo incentivizes crime.
You wouldn't say that?
I would say scarcity incentivizes crime. Scarcity is often manufactured. So what would be a good thing about letting go of all monetary? What's anything else there? Is there anything else there?
I get more sun. Get more exercise, probably. Meet more people. You're not, you know, again, you're off the system. So you don't have to worry about what time it is.
You're not late schedules, to anything. Yeah.
DMV visits.
Oh, man.
Yeah, there's a lot of positives there. In those terms. In terms of like freedom in that sense.
Okay.
Freedom from the cultural institutions and
freedom from
structures of day-to-day life. Yeah.
Freedom from the dish pit. The dish pit is for those in the restaurant world when you do the dishes in a restaurant.
Yeah.
I've done it. You've done it. We've all done it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an excellent use of human capacity, but it does do other things, and it clearly is a job that will be automated further and further. It's almost automated now.
Yeah. But there's still that human element
mm-hmm.
of discretion, being able to tell, oh, well, this dish is broken, or that didn't come off, or... you know, it could all be automated though, pretty easily.
Yeah. They could notice hairline cracks better than we could. Mm-hmm. And they could scan for debris. It's all crazy. Okay. So what would be a downside of going hobo, like letting go? What would be a thing you'd lose from choosing that path?
You might have compromised health because you have no, can't visit a doctor or anything like that.
So like you can't cut visit yourself, you just kind of tape it up and hope for the best.
You're not in the system, so you couldn't get welfare or employment help.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess unless you carried around your Social Security card or something.
Well, even if you just were in a life of not pursuing money, you just go into any hospital and people will fix you.
Hmm.
That's how America works.
Downside is you have to scavenge for
everything.
Food.
Scavenge is a good word. I like that
scravenge word. Scavenge for food and shelter.
It's like scrape.
And you're constantly scavenge. at the mercy of the authorities trying to shut down your shelter, wherever you've decided to put it.
You know.
But like, you know, struggling to find sustenance. That's like a big, it seems like a big struggle.
Like your food, water, beer, cannabis.
Just food, even.
Yeah.
Water seems like pretty easy. A lot of public fountains.
Yeah, and if you got a couple Nalgenes or
library.
Camelbacks, you could make do.
But food seems harder to do.
Well, there are places that give away food around. You could get some from there.
Mm.
You could also, I mean,
I guess you could hike. You could hitchhike.
Yeah.
Or ride the rails to travel around.
Totally. You could be always traveling.
Could be.
But what do you do when you get sick? I think if I was, when I'm super, have a cold or flu, the modern store-bought Walgreens things like, you know, NyQuil and DayQuil just affect my well-being a tremendous amount when I'm sick. You think about the going hobo pursuit, there's maybe a lot of that would be lost because mm-hmm. you're not buying a lot of stuff.
Right.
You get money. I mean, how do you get money to do anything? Maybe it's all sweep the floor if you give me $5.
That's a disadvantage of not being in the social system.
Yeah, so that's another down on the
going hobo. You don't play by the rules, you don't get, you know, you don't get money.
Well, when you, I ask these questions because when you kind of get kicked in the teeth a bunch of different directions, all really at the same time, I think many of us get discouraged in playing the game because you're mm-hmm. like, you're losing here, and then there's this new thing and a ticket, and then this. And then that, and your insurance is like, and then you're at a job where you don't really survive, and the game sort of seems like impossible to win. And then you get a parking ticket,
right?
And you're just like, fuck. There's so many.
I don't think it's a win.
Taxed is everything. Everything is just being. You're always paying whatever you do, anywhere you go.
I don't think it's a zero sum game that one can win.
Money?
Just the capitalist socioeconomic system.
No, that, like, utopia.
You can't really win at anything.
Yeah.
Best you can do is, like, maybe have some savings for your kids or something.
Well, I think the best you could do is incremental improvements to the socioeconomic system that included modern day information.
Yeah, maybe that'll happen.
I think so.
Systems are constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think if our system never changed, there would just come along. There would be some other country that came up with a better system, and that country would rise in ascendancy.
Is that what would happen, basically?
I can't say for sure, but that seems like a plausible outcome. Because it seems like, in general, the best systems win, in the sense that they become adopted and used and increase human well-being.
I'll agree to that.
Right? That's why America's scene is so great, because our system is pretty good. It's not perfect. A lot of problems. But again, pretty good.
Yeah. There are some
and that's
truly not, embarrassing historical facts.
And that's not to say it can't be improved. It will. It has to. Because all things change.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thank you. So. That was like, that's nice. That was very good. Do you have a topic?
I have a brief little topic.
Oh, okay.
It's probably going to be a little shorter episode here today.
Yeah. A little sore.
Just looking into Bitcoin.
Oh, okay.
Cryptocurrencies, which we know are not centralized. They're decentralized. That's what makes them so different.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with legal tender dollar bills in the United States, the Federal Reserve is the central governing body, right? Bitcoin, there's no Federal Reserve of Bitcoin. And there's some weird things about it. It was introduced in 2009, which is a long time ago. Not that long ago.
Now, doesn't it actually run on American U.S. currency credit?
No. I mean, you can exchange it into any currency you want. Right now, I think one Bitcoin is something like $900 in value. So that's a pricey coin. So one thing that's weird about it, invented by an unidentified programmer. So they don't even know who invented it. Now you could go all conspiracy theory here and say
it was introduced
from somebody. It might be a team of people, but someone calling themselves Satoshi Nakamoto. And there's speculation as to who this person is. People have come forward claiming that they're this person. And there's lots of speculation. It's very interesting. So think about that. A currency that's introduced and the person who created it doesn't really want to take credit. No pun intended.
Oh.
Could be a group of people. Could be a single programmer. It's kind of interesting. It's a virtual currency, cryptocurrency. It's the first decentralized digital currency.
So
there's also a finite number of bitcoins that will be created.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's going to be a maximum?
There's going to be a maximum. I think it's 21 million. And bitcoins are created on sort of a, it becomes exponentially harder to create. Existentially harder too, probably. It becomes exponentially harder to create more bitcoins.
Why is that?
So there's like these mining farms, they're called, which are just banks of computers that are running mathematical processes on the Bitcoin, basically blockchain is what they call it, which is a series of blocks of encrypted information. And so you process enough of these, solve it, and you can mine Bitcoin from that. And each time a Bitcoin is created, it gets harder and harder. It takes more time to create another Bitcoin.
Oh, so the last Bitcoin will like almost never be created because it'll take too long or something?
It will eventually be created, but, you know, there'll be like one Bitcoin created every 4 years.
Oh,
eventually,
shit.
Very slowly. And then once 21 million Bitcoins is reached, that's the end. No more created. I think that's going to be a while. But, yeah, it's just fascinating. See if I can pull up some stats here.
Do you? Yeah, me too. Do you have a Bitcoin? What do you think about
it? I don't have an account.
No. Can you have a part of a Bit? Can you have $5 of a Bitcoin?
Yeah, you can have like decimal. You have 0.032 Bitcoins.
Okay.
I'm not sure how many figures that goes to. A lot of people have predicted its death many times.
That it just will fall under.
Yeah, and those times have come and gone.
Now, not many places take Bitcoin. When you go, think about the places you shop for whatever food and mm-hmm. things that you live in life. No, how many of them actually go, oh, yeah, we'll take Bitcoin?
Walmart.
Walmart takes Bitcoin?
Yeah.
They shop at Walmart?
Me, no.
Oh.
I have.
Yeah.
But not on a regular basis.
They take Walmart? I mean, Bitcoin. Really?
They do, yeah.
Huh.
Some other big companies too. Trying to pull up some stats.
Well, you're pulling up those stats. I thought I understood Bitcoin to be still sort of based on American U.S. currency in a sense that if the currency collapsed, Bitcoin would also collapse.
No, because it's not backed. It's not backed by something. I mean, to get to your point of manufactured scarcity, that's the whole basis, right? There's only so many in circulation. So if you have one, it's valuable.
Okay, up to a certain point. This is seriously hot off the press. 2 hours ago, this was released about Bitcoin. You ready?
What do we got?
Bitcoin has been trading between $1,114 and $887 this week. According to the BLX, in extremely volatile market conditions with intense bearish momentum, the network hash rate gained 3.24% on March 3rd and has increased 42.8% year to date. The most important fundamental news this week that has been back and forth exchange between Bitcoin Unlimited, BU, and Bitcoin Core, BC, factions. BU miner signaling continues to gain ground up to 10% this week. Nodes, however, remain heavily in BC's favor. So I guess it's all volatile and the values jump around a bunch. Meanwhile, the previous quarterly futures contract with OKCoin closes this week. Below is a chart showing the quarterly contract open dates, orange, previous quarterly moving by the previous quarter contract closing yellow. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. I'm sure it does if you really stare at it for a really long time, but apparently they're saying it's at the end here, right? They're calling it the crash.
Mm. Which has been called
many times.
Many times. And here it is
2 hours ago.
Yeah.
Another call. So are they scared of it? This is just market people going, no.
I don't know. I think people don't really know what to do with it. I've heard people say that there's no way that Bitcoin will ever be secure. Your wallet can always be hacked. Yeah, it's very strange. Some nonprofits accept Bitcoin, Greenpeace. There are other cryptocurrencies too, but Bitcoin is the one that's had the most traction.
Cryptocurrencies. I appreciate the idea of...
It's anonymous too.
Considering other currencies.
You can't trace who's, you know...
And you can steal a bunch of it. Somebody has, right?
Yeah, and it can be used anonymously, which is why... It's been used on the dark web, quote unquote, for illicit trading of goods and services. But I don't, you know, just on the face of it, I'm like, kind of like, I don't know. I thought it was just a new, I thought it was relatively new. I didn't know it was 9 years old. And I thought it was kind of like, I just thought it would fail.
But it's still
somehow
sort of,
I absorbed all that propaganda that it would just fail. And who knows? It could fail easily.
Would you want to own some Bitcoin? You seem to be.
I don't know.
Are you in favor of it as an idea?
I mean, kind of.
It seems like there's some things about it that would be good to pursue. Perhaps elements like that there's a cap of how many can be made and some other sort of limiting factors. It could be a more humane system.
I mean, if you want to get rid of the Federal Reserve,
yeah,
Bitcoin is your currency.
I guess so.
It's not centralized. And they can't just make, they can't just mint more Bitcoins at a whim.
Yeah.
They have to mine them and wait, and there's a maximum. So it's very different from traditional money, where money is just made and, you know, injected into the economy.
So what equations are being solved when you're mining these Bitcoins? Like, what are we solving, problems, or is it just like random time wasting?
I guess you could say it's random time wasting.
Well, you got anything else on Bitcoin?
Just that, it's fascinating. Decentralized cryptocurrency. 12.5 Bitcoins are created approximately every 10 minutes until 2020. And then afterwards, 6.25 Bitcoins per block for 4 years. Whoa. So it like keeps halving in the amount you can produce. This halving continues until 2110 or 2140, when 21 million Bitcoins will have been issued. So we still got another...
So we got
about 100 years in this.
We got a little time still. We could still invest. Okay. Huh.
Invented by an unknown programmer. Very weird. Let me get to your point about the mathematics thing.
Yeah. Get to my point about the mathematics. Yeah.
In order to be, so the, there's a public ledger of transactions, which is called the blockchain. It's just data. And it's sort of distributed. I think it's like 6 times an hour or something. So every 10 minutes, there's like a broadcast signal. Everyone updates the ledger. There's no central service that does that. So in order to be accepted by the rest of the network, a new block, so when you're mining Bitcoins, you're creating, trying to create new blocks. A new block must contain a so-called proof of work. The proof of work requires miners to find a number called a nonce, such that when the block content is hashed along with the nonce, the result is numerically smaller than the network's difficulty target. So this proof is easy for any node in the network to verify, but extremely time consuming to generate. So that's how you mine bit, that's how you produce new Bitcoins.
Can you translate that into
basically doing mathematical work on a bunch of information? And it's easy to verify when it's been done, but it's super hard to actually do the work. So computers are just sitting there.
Sifting numbers.
Sifting numbers. They solve the problem. Once it's verified, a new Bitcoin is created.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very cool. So every 14 days, the difficulty is adjusted with the aim of keeping the average time between new blocks at 10 minutes. So between March 1st, 2014 and March 1st, 2015, the number of nonces miners had to try before creating a new block increased from 16.4 quintillion to 200.5 quintillion.
Why don't we just
So there's like rooms in a lot of the mining stations have like a warehouse in Sweden, say, or some north country that's cold, because you want a cold atmosphere to cool all the computers you have in this warehouse. And all the computers are just working on these sifting numbers, working on these mathematical problems. It's fucking weird, isn't it?
Well, can we just do a small scale thing at home? Can we like take an old phone?
It wouldn't be cost effective, because it would take you like years and years and years to
we get like one.
One, yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting.
Digital currencies, virtual currencies. It's just a number. It's just a thing. It's made up.
It's like an alternative religion. It's sort of like an offshoot.
What's the belief of it, though? Just the belief that it has value?
The belief that it has value. And that it's worth whatever, you know, services and things.
Yeah. Well, if everyone agrees that it has worth, then it does have worth.
Pretty much.
Right?
Pretty much.
Except for the hobos.
Right.
Because they don't agree that it has worth. But no. It still has worth for the majority of people.
Yeah. People are using it, and it's hard to get.
But there's always a lot of buzz around it. Bitcoin. It's just always... seems to always be in the news, especially recently. Always recently.
Always.
So that was my topic.
Okay.
If anyone knows the identity of Nakamoto, let us know.
Yeah, send us a message.
Who knows? Maybe it's Final Corp.
Do you have your sound effects ready?
Mm-hmm.
Can we get like a drum roll or something?
I don't have a drum roll, unfortunately.
Jimmy, we got anything? Yeah. Okay, it is now time to quiz Aubrey. Oh, Aubrey, we have an art history quiz here for you today.
Huh.
And you know, we gotta have some sound effects with you, and we gotta be ready to do this. So this quiz comes from the internet, and what is bas relief? When a sculpture remains attached to the plane it was carved from, with a shallow depth and low contrast between the background and sculpture, or a metalworking technique where a malleable metal surface is hammered against a raised relief to create an impression on the metal.
Two choices?
Mm-hmm. Bas relief.
First one.
Ooh, that is correct. Okay, number two. Approximately when did the Rococo movement begin? There are 4 years. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
1625, 1725, 1825, 1925.
1725.
That is correct. I think, Who painted Liberty Leading the People? It's the painting where the lady is wearing a dress, but it has come below her bosom, and she's holding up the flag. And mm-hmm. there's like a bunch of war and stuff, and she's like, you know, Liberty charges us forward. There's four. Pablo Picasso, Eugene Delacroix, Theodore Geraldt, Caspar David Friedrich.
The second one.
Eugene Delacroix. That is correct.
Huh. I guessed. I figured it was maybe probably a Frenchman, because the Statue of Liberty was a gift from France. Mm-hmm. So I figured maybe a French guy would be into that, paint it. And it's sort of sexy. And you know how the French are, right?
They're always into romance.
Into the ooh la la. Huh. I'm seeing a picture.
Which art movement does this painting belong to? So it's a black background.
A painting of a man's face. A
picture of a white guy's face. He's middle-aged. There's a mustache and a white collar. Maybe he's a preacher.
Hmm. Are there choices or just mm-hmm. full-on guess? Okay,
so you got it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's a full-on guess.
Full-on guess. What art movement does that belong to? Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Realism. Realist art movement.
Okay, that's a secret answer for later. Number five. Who is it a self-portrait of? Emile Nold.
Who is the self... That picture?
Mm-hmm. Emile Nold. Edvard Munch. Robert Delinoir. Otto Dix.
Munch.
That is correct.
Huh.
Who painted this piece? Now, it's a picture of a lady, and she's got a mostly see-through blue dress on, but she is a giant. She is as tall as these city buildings, and she's playing a funky-looking guitar, and she's got a really serious look on her face.
Huh, okay.
Okay, got it. Full on guess.
Let me see one more time, please.
So it's like she's got a blue dress on. She's got big arms. She's playing stringed instrument. Red hair, red lipstick, solemn. She's like, there's big city buildings behind her. Red fingernail polish.
Looks like what does that style remind me of? I'm going to say Degas.
D-E-G-A-S. G-A-S. Yeah, I think that's wrong.
Yeah. Probably Picasso.
Number seven. What is the name of the Frida Kahlo Museum in Mexico?
Oh, man. No clue. That's a full-on guess?
Yeah, full-on guess.
I have no idea.
Okay. What should I type in?
Kahlo Museum.
Kahlo. C-A-L-O.
C-A-H-L-O. Her name.
Okay, I think that was also wrong. Number eight. What work created a stir at the Salon in 1863 for its depiction of nudity. Ooh. Impressionism, Sunrise by Claude Monet, The Bellili Family by Edgar Degas, The Luncheon on the Grass by Edouard Manet.
Degas. Second one.
Ooh, incorrect. Luncheon on the Grass by Edouard Manet.
Huh. Okay.
Which of these works was painted by Pablo Picasso? We got a brown squiggly line one. We got a blue guy, gray guy. He's looking pretty fucked up. And then we have like universe, angle, dimensional travel. Which of these works was painted by Pablo Picasso? We're going to be live streaming soon, folks. You're going to be looking at these with us. It's going to be great. Okay, we're going with brown angles. Correct. Yes. How could you tell? What about that was, you know?
Second one seemed like a knockoff of Picasso. Someone trying to do cubism in the style of Picasso. Whereas the first one seemed like an actual picture that Picasso had cubismed into total obscurity. But it looks like an actual face that he drew from. So that's why.
And the third one, how would you tell it wasn't?
It seemed too, I don't know, modern.
It's not as fancy angularly.
Yeah.
What is this painting by Jean Miró called? It's just a bunch of crazy-ass animals with squiggly lines. Looks like a cartoon explosion inside a house.
I wish I knew. Jean Miró.
The Harlequin's Carnival.
Huh.
Dutch Interiors.
Hmm.
The Farm.
You say The Farm.
Ooh, incorrect. The Harlequin's Carnival. Where is Vincent van Gogh's The Starry Night displayed? The Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. The Museum of Modern Art in New York. Musée d'Orsay in Paris, France.
Three.
Ooh, is incorrect. It is in New York.
It is?
Yep.
Yeah. Where's his ear? That's the question.
Where's his ear?
Yeah.
His ear's missing?
Yeah, he cut off his ear and gave it to some chick.
Yep.
For attention. He just wanted attention.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And his grandson...
Okay, can we get a drum roll? Oh, no, go ahead. Keep going.
His Vincent Van Gogh's grandson was a movie maker.
Really?
He was murdered by Muslims in Amsterdam.
Really?
Yeah.
Like on purpose because he made a movie?
Yeah. Totally on purpose.
It wasn't like an innocent explosion.
Yeah.
Just one of those random neighborhood
death bombs. Didn't just happen. Yeah, it wasn't just a suicide bomb that just happened to go off. It was intentional. It wasn't a bomb. I think it was stabbing.
He was stabbed.
He was stabbed and killed.
For making movies.
Yeah, I think because he made a movie. It was like the innocence of Muslims. He made a movie about Muslims.
Did.
Islam.
Oh, he
so
did.
And they didn't like it, so he killed him.
Well.
So.
That's a really
piece of trivia.
Unfortunate bit of, that's, I would call that. Not a choice I would make.
Yeah.
If someone made a movie I didn't like, I don't think I should kill them.
What if they were listening, someone that was listening to, like, Van Halen. 14-year-old kid was listening to some Western music. Would you kill him?
No. Again.
It's something they do. They had beheading, specifically.
Eesh.
Film and behead a 14-year-old kid.
ISIS and similar groups.
Mm-hmm. kid was caught listening to quote-unquote Western music. Who knows what it
really,
was.
Really? A kid?
Yeah, 14-year-old.
Sad. Okay, final question. Number 12, and finally, who wrote the first Dada Manifesto?
Oh, I shouldn't know this, but I don't.
Hugo Ball, Tristan Tzara, Marcel Duchamp, Max Ernst.
Tristan Tzara.
Ooh, is incorrect. Hugo Ball, which was actually my guess. Just going to say. Wow.
Damn. I didn't get many right. Like four. What's my score?
Let's see.
Zero.
And the answer is five.
I got five. I got a 50.
Five.
F.
Okay. Good game. That's
a good quiz.
So,
study up on my art history.
Yeah, that was. I figured we'd get you there. So, I've got another topic.
It's almost time for me to go.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time.
So,
well, maybe
you want to save that topic for next week?
Yeah, let's save that topic.
Is that possible?
It's possible. And then let's just finish with our audience. What wouldn't it be cool if? And let's just...
What wouldn't it be cool if?
Mm-hmm. What wouldn't it be cool if?
Okay. Post your answer on empathyandimagination.com. Feel free to visit us on iTunes, you know, give a review, make it an honest review. That's how you can support this show. You can also go to patreon.com/empathyandimagination. Pitch in some bucks and increase your lux.
Beauty, beauty.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everybody, for taking the time to listen to the show.
See you next time. See. Really see. Hopefully we'll be live streaming next time.
Yeah, so maybe even you really see.